Hey, welcome, welcome. So, yeah.
I have a couple questions.
Yeah.
So I have a question about posture. Specifically, at what level would you rather me ask the question, then give the example, or give the example and then ask the question?
Example first, maybe.
Okay.
That's all I can focus on.
So dealing with a specific type of product, which are dietary supplements. So there are a couple of things that go into that. The first of which is, where's the line between, like food per se and medicine, which would have to do with what stringencies you have to have as far as hecture and things like that. And then the next question is, if in this specific case you can rule that it's food and it needs a hecture, it needs to be kosher, things like this, the question becomes, at what level is it fleishik, milkic, things like this? Like, I'm talking on a molecular level, is something going to make you?
So let me just say that there is a general rule, and then I guess by your question, you see you understand this, that generally the laws of kashrus only apply to food, and they don't apply to things that are not food. Now, the normal demarcation between food and not food is there a taste? So, for example, when you're dealing with chewable vitamins that have flavoring added, then you've got a kashrus problem. When you're dealing with things you just swallow that don't have any taste, or their taste would be very, very bitter if you actually chewed it, so then the laws of kashrus does not apply. So I would basically say it depends if the dietary supplements have a taste or not a taste. Now, in terms of meat and milk, there I think the answer is even easier, because certainly things are not defined as meat and milk by molecular on a molecular basis. There is a law of 60, meaning to say, if the dairy component or the meat component is less than 1/60, around 8%, whatever the percent is, of the total product, it is nullified in that type of ratio majority, and it's considered to be non-existent. I mean, if a drop of milk, let's imagine I have a meat soup cooking on the oven, on the stovetop, and some milk pours in. If the milk is less than 1/60 of the whole in terms of volume, it is nullified, and I'm allowed to eat the product as meat. So that would be the question. Anything that's less than an 8% or slightly more than 8% does not have a milk, meat, or dairy problem.
Okay, on that note, then I have a clarification and then a follow-up question.
Yeah.
The clarification is that, so I'm not necessarily, first off, typically I'm talking about products in which there are powders that you put into liquids. So my question, I guess I'll start with this. How does the 1/60th rule play in when you're diluting it like that?
So first of all, let me point out that certainly if you're mixing it with milk or juice, the laws of kashrus absolutely do
Water,
apply.
typically.
Or water, yeah, but the laws of kashrus do apply. Now, the way you compute it, though, it's a bit of a complicated ratio, because you don't need 60 times the powder. That would be impossible. But you kind of have to figure out, and I don't know how you'll get this information, what percentage of the powder is the non-kosher ingredient? And then you ask yourself whether the water plus the part of the powder that is kosher, is that 60 times the non-kosher ingredient that is in the mix? So essentially, you get the benefit of combining the water and the powder to create a volume against the non-kosher ingredient, which would typically be a very small percentage. So you may very well have 60, but I can't, verify it unless you've got an exact percentage.
Yeah, that would
So that
probably.
would be hard to do, I think. Yeah, so I would say that the best thing to do is to try to find nutritional supplements that have kosher supervision, of which there are,
Yeah.
obviously every product has its own individual benefit, but usually you could find some kosher substitute.
Okay.
Let me just remind you as well though, that with nutritional supplements, you have to keep in mind that even if there is no meat ingredients, like gelatin or something like that, even things like grape juice do raise contrast problems, because if non-Jews had handled wine or grape juice...
Well, okay, so...
And a lot of artificial flavorings, if there are, can also come from insect derivation or the like. Beetles.
Right. So, I guess then... So, the most common protein supplement that's used modernly is whey protein, which is from milk.
Yep.
So, I'm allergic to whey, for instance, which is true. So, I have a protein that is a beef derivative. It's derived from, the protein is derived from beef.
Yeah.
But that is not to say that it is beef. You know, once you're extracting the protein out of the meat.
Yeah, so you're actually talking about a very, very, very controversial question in the laws of kashrut, and that is, at what point do the derivatives of forbidden products, even pig or whatever it is, at what point do they undergo such a processing and a chemical transformation that they are no longer considered to be connected with the original product? This came up with even something like gelatin. Gelatin is the collagen of bones, etc. And there were some great rabbis who took the position that even gelatin that is derived from animal sources is halakhically kosher, because it goes through a state in which it's no longer edible, and then you mix it with other things. So to be honest, there is a halachic basis that these types of derivatives do not have to be kosher, even if they come. So I'm not going to tell you that for sure it's against halacha. I will tell you that the trend of most religious authorities today is to be stringent on both gelatin and on this type of processing. So,
well, it's also chocolate flavored. So realistically, it needs a hexher in the first place.
Okay, well, that's right, because of that alone, right.
But just on a more specific level.
Yeah, you are correct. There is a halachic argument that the chemical processing destroys its connection to meat. It is no longer meat. It is a derivative that's been processed. And there were great rabbis who permitted it, including the great Rav Chaim Moser Grodzinski of Vilna. I don't know if the name is familiar to you, but before World War II, he was the greatest halachic authority in Europe. But the trend has been to be strict. So, you know, you can actually find some even English writing on this issue. It's a very controversial discussion.
Awesome.
Yeah. Okay, anything?
I have plenty more, but I figure I'll...
We have a small group, so you'll probably have a chance to ask.
Whatever
you ask, if anyone has any
questions.
Okay, so unless Mashiach wants to say something, are you a college student or finished college or in college?
I just finished the first year of college, so
Very good. Well, okay, well, welcome. It's good to have you. You know, during the, your birthday is not Tisha B'Av, though.
No. No, it's the same as Moshe Rabbeinu's.
Seventh of Adar.
Yeah.
Wow, wonderful. Okay, great. So why don't you keep on asking again?
Okay. Let's see here. Okay, so I'm a little curious about exceptions and exemptions to Minhagim based on things like, elaboration.
Yeah. This is a very, very interesting and complicated topic. Not an easy topic at all. You know, we commonly divide halacha. Halacha is mandatory. The mandatory rules of Judaism, into two big, gigantic categories. We have doraisa, which are the laws of the Torah, but that also includes rabbinic explanation of those laws.
Right.
That is still doraisa. Versus pure rabbinic laws, such as lighting Hanukkah candles and the like. And although we do have to obey both, but the halachic system does make differentiations between da'oraisa and da'rabanan, and there are certain leniencies in rabbinic law that may not apply to Torah law. For example, if I'm in doubt if a Torah law applies, I have to be strict. If I'm in doubt if a rabbinic law applies, I can be lenient. But then there's a huge third category, which is somewhat less defined, and that is called minhag. Now, minhag is not a Torah law, and it's not even a mandatory rabbinic law, but it is the various customs that either the Jewish people as a whole, but usually not the Jewish people as a whole, or particular subgroups, whether it's Ashkenazim from Europe or Sfardim from North Africa, they have assumed, or even within subgroups, there may be Moroccan minhagim, Syrian minhagim, Iranian minhagim, or Persian minhagim, there may be Polish, there may be Hungarian, right? These are minhagim. And the minhagim usually started through the guidance of great rabbis, but sometimes it's grassroots. Sometimes it started from the people, and the rabbis, you know, endorsed it or considered it proper. Now, there are even minhagim from Talmudic times. For example, the Talmud indicates that davening the Ma'ariv prayer, not the Shema, but the Amida of Ma'ariv, was originally non-obligatory, and it became a custom. So even something like that, which has been a custom for probably over 1,000 years, still has its roots.
Ma'ariv was not.
It's an argument in the Gemara, but according to one opinion in the Gemara, which we paskin like, the Shimon Esrei, not the Shema, the Shimon Esrei of Ma'ariv is a custom. It's not a Doraisa, not a Drabanan, it's a minhag that we now have to do. Now, minhagim, interestingly enough, morph into halacha. That's interesting. Something that starts as a minhag, you now got to do it. Like Ma'ariv is a good example. I would not have the right to say, oh, I'm going to skip Ma'ariv today. It's only a minhag. Minhag becomes obligatory.
Ma'ariv was established by Yaakov.
Well, that's a good question, because on one hand, there's a Talmudic passage that says Avraham did Shachris and Yitzchak did Mincha and Yaakov did Ma'ariv. And yet, there's another view in the Gemara that says the tefilos are because of the sacrificial cycle in the Beis Hamikdash. Which means Shachris was the morning offering and Mincha is the afternoon offering, but at Ma'ariv there wasn't any mandatory offering, there was only leftover Evarim that would be burnt at night. So it would seem that the halachic opinion that Ma'ariv is optional is connecting the davening to the sacrifices rather than the patriarch. So there's a bit of a contradiction there. Because Maimonides, again, that's a long talk. Maimonides, on one hand, does bring exactly your teaching that Avram did Shachris, Yitzchak, Mincha, Yaakov, Ma'ariv, Arvit, and yet Maimonides also rules that the Ma'ariv prayer is optional. So it was a minhag. So it's a very good kasha, it's a good contradiction. So I'm sorry, I forgot you. So you're asking about minhag, what was your
specific question? So my question is specifically, so minhagim become law, but there are also a lot of exceptions to this and that and the other.
Well, here's the thing. The basic problem is this. The basic problem is, to what extent do you have freedom as an adult Jewish person to self-choose the community whose minhagim you want to adopt? Now, that's a major thing. We often say, as the normal default rule is, you're supposed to follow the minhagim of your father. Which would suggest if your father is Sephardic, you know, you're Sephardic. If your father is Ashkenazic, Ashkenazic. And yet, we find, number one, certainly in the case of a Baal Tshuva, let's say a person's father was not religious. The poskim do say you have a certain freedom. You could choose to be Sephardic. You know, if your father is an Ashkenaz coming from Germany, but he doesn't keep the commandments, you're free to self-affiliate. And many opinions say that even if you were born into a religious home, you can choose as an adult to connect to another community. Because really, what creates your obligation of minhagim is not so much your family as it is the community with whom you choose to affiliate. However, once you choose to affiliate, generally speaking, you are bound by the minhagim of that community. You should not pick and choose that much. You shouldn't say, oh, I like Sephardic Shachris, but I like Ashkenazic Mincha, and you shouldn't go back and forth in those matters. But I think people are surprised to know that, at least when there are strong reasons, a person does have a certain freedom to affiliate. After all, if you think about this, everybody who became a chassid, Chassidus began, whatever it is, in the middle of the 18th century. Now, anybody who became a chassid was by definition turning their back on the customs of their family and their community, but this was a new community that was created. So we kind of recognize there's an ability to affiliate that way.
So on the three levels of Yeresiv, Yeruvim, and Mizrachim, you have different things, you know. Typically, you know, the standard exemption of pretty much anything Yeresa is to save a life.
Oh, okay. So you're asking, I got you.
I'm asking how they differentiate.
All right, so you're right. For Torah laws, basic rule is that you have to keep Torah laws unless a life is threatened. Even
right.
if it's a small threat, but if it's a real threat, mm-hmm. you violate the Torah law. For rabbinic laws, mm-hmm. The standard is you can violate rabbinic laws in case of great illness, even if it's not life-threatening,
okay.
etc., or loss of limb or something like that. For minhagim, things are different. You know, it's hard to quantify, it depends on the minhag, but we will often say for significant financial loss.
Okay.
When
so that's
violate minhag.
So that's actually the source that kind of created the question for me.
Yes.
So I'll give a specific example and see if we can come up with something on that. So 3 weeks, Ashkenazi,
I
think it would just be
Ashkenazi. Don't shave your haircuts the whole 3 weeks.
And music also.
That's correct.
Okay, so I have it's a very specific case, right? So I have my livelihood is dependent on I'm in the music industry. I'm a DJ, so my livelihood is actually dependent on listening and working with music.
Yeah.
So now, I'm sure that based on that reasoning, you know, if I said to you, oh well, I have to, you know, do a performance or something like that, I've heard that that's more or less okay. Mm-hmm. So now we're looking at a little bit more of a stretch, because the fact of the matter is, I'm here in yeshiva, I'm not working.
Yeah.
But I've been doing this job since I was 12 years old. Okay, so I've been...
Are you on the radio, or you do it for parties and things?
I've been on the radio, but typically parties and such.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the way that, and you know, when I train, I've trained about 50 guys to do what I do over the years. And what I tell them is, you're always, every time you listen to a song, you're practicing. You're learning. The more music you know, the better of a performer you become. You have to know the intricacies of the music.
Yeah.
So the question becomes, you know, without the 3 weeks if I'm sitting in my room by myself, you know, on my phone, I would typically be listening to my iPod. I would be doing something, even on the most basis of levels, that has to do with music.
Yeah.
So the question is that close enough to be, you know, practicing, thinking about, is that close enough or not?
Well, you know, again, here I think I would give you an interesting answer. I actually think halachically, in terms of the minhagim,
mm-hmm.
you would be permitted to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would still tend to advise you against it. And the reason I would say that, within limits, is that in halacha as well as minhag, there is both a spirit of the law and the letter of the law.
Okay.
And even letter of the minhag. While the letter of the minhag would not interfere with what you feel is useful for your profession.
Right.
This is, after all, a time of mourning, a time of sadness, a time in which we are supposed to deprive ourselves of certain pleasures
mm-hmm.
to mourn the destruction of the temple. So I would think that it would be a worthwhile idea that indeed you kind of disengage
mm-hmm.
from this type of activity, because it brings a person happiness and joy. But if you're asking me as a matter of strict halakha, is
mm-hmm.
it forbidden for you, I think that this would fall within the analogy permitting a musician to practice,
right.
even if there's no job, during the 3 weeks on the grounds that he needs to improve his skills.
Right.
So I would say that it is permitted, but I would still encourage you to have a certain amount of disengagement from this.
Interesting.
And even if you're doing it, don't do it as often as you would do it. Or,
So the compromise, I kind of had, you know, similar thoughts, and the compromise that I came up with was at the beginning of the 3 weeks, especially considering the fact that I'm more or less very newly observant in the first place.
Right.
So I listened to my iPod for a few days, and then when it died, I haven't recharged it yet.
Okay, okay. Well, I think that's giving God something here.
Yeah, that's a, you know, it's all about compromise.
Yeah, okay, okay. It makes sense. Now, again, this is unique to your situation. I mean, if somebody else who's not a professional involved in this, they would not be allowed to do this at all, right?
Exactly.
So halacha and minhag does accommodate the needs of somebody who's part of their job.
Okay. Yeah. I really don't want to monopolize
this. That was good. That was good.
You're on the stand, you know.
So.
But are you from Arizona too? Are you both of you?
No, I'm from Philadelphia. Though we are roommates.
Okay.
Yeah. So taking that that whole topic and just kind of shifting it over a little bit. So for fasting, okay? There are a number of people who are exempt from fasting, although, you know, they should. So this is kind of a philosophical and halakhic thing. I've spoken to a number of people who are exempt from fasting, who then so I say to them, okay, so what do you do? So the question becomes, do you eat the bare minimum to sustain yourself so that you are not ill? Do you eat the bare minimum to sustain yourself so you are neutral? Or do you eat yourself, eat, you know, with enough
substance
that you are actually able to fulfill what you're supposed to do? So I'll elaborate on that. You know, your average hypoglycemic must eat, or else major consequences. So, you know, if they don't eat at all, they'll pass out, they'll end up in the hospital.
Right.
If they eat this much, okay, so they won't pass out, they won't end up in the hospital, but they'll pretty much be in bed all day. If they eat this much, you know, it takes this much to get them out of bed, and it takes this much to sit there and learn Torah all day. So, what do you do?
Yeah, that's a very excellent question. Let me first say that let's separate out Yom Kippur from every other fast.
Yeah.
Now, Yom Kippur, anyway, you're only allowed to eat as a matter of life, potential life and death, and that may include hypoglycemic.
Mm-hmm.
But Yom Kippur, we clearly work with the ideas that you have to do the absolute minimums.
Right.
Meaning to say, anything beyond survival level is not permitted, and then there's even the amount you're allowed to eat and the spacing and the like. So that's Yom Kippur. So Yom Kippur, I think the answer is going to be very, very clear. And even if that means you're going to be in bed all day, and even if it means you're going to sleep all day, that's better. Better to do that and eat as little as you need to than to even go to synagogue and daven and everything else. Now, with respect to the other fasts, there is a different calculation. The other fasts are rabbinic. They are not Torah law. Even Tisha B'Av. Yom Kippur is the only fast that is a requirement of the Torah. Because they are rabbinic, I had indicated, in cases of severe debilitating illness, even if it's not life-threatening.
Right. And
certainly hypoglycemia would count as that. The fast does not apply at all, which means technically a person is allowed, in that condition, is allowed to eat and drink whatever they need to bring them to their normal functioning level.
Right.
Now the question becomes, okay, but is there a spirit of the law here?
That's the same.
And here, I think it's a little tricky because it really depends. If the idea is that because they only eat the minimum, they're going to have to sleep all day, and they're not really spending the day in prayer and meditation, it might be, in their condition, it's better for them to eat and be able to daven and meditate than to simply be unconscious or, you know, in a sleeper all day.
Right.
If, on the other hand, they would be capable of prayer and meditation, but they would just be feeling a little bit uncomfortable, then I think it is worthwhile for them to experience the discomfort with the rest of the congregation. So my short answer is, under the strict reading of the halacha, once somebody is classified as someone who needs to eat, then they are not subject to that fast at all. But whether or not they should voluntarily be stricter on themselves would depend on what they're able to do in that condition.
Right.
Now, I would say this much. No matter what, even if they conclude that they need to eat normally, I think there would still be a concept of refraining from luxury foods. So, although I haven't seen them in my nutrients anyway, but you don't have to have the chocolate cake or the delicious milkshake. You can have bread and water and basic staples. So at least you shouldn't have luxurious, fun, food that gives you a lot of pleasure.
No filet.
Yeah, no. Try to keep it away from pleasure and take it in for maintenance and fuel.
Okay.
But again, Yom Kippur, absolutely clear, you got to stick to the absolute minimums. Even if that means you're not going to daven at all. Okay, that's fine. Sure.
Okay. This question that I've had for years, it comes up in my research every now and then because I'm a robotics researcher, and I'm just going to get straight to the point. Are you allowed to use prosthetic limbs on holidays? And there are two kinds.
Yes.
There are those that are integrated into your muscular system, which you cannot just disconnect, and there are those that you can disconnect.
Yeah.
So what are the approaches on those two?
Yeah, excellent question. Now let me ask you this. The prosthetic limb is obviously controlled by electrical impulses.
Yes.
Are they the electrical impulses of the neurons, the neurological system itself, or are they an artificial source of electricity?
Okay, so they are powered by a rechargeable battery. But there are some that directly connect to your nervous system, and some that are controlled by muscular movements from a different organ.
Okay, but so here is the thing. To the degree that they are controlled by the neurological system, whether through one muscle group or another muscle group, and that is the fuel, so to speak. So the same principle that says you're allowed to move, right, even though you're generating electricity, you would be allowed to utilize those prostheses.
If it's integrated.
If it's integrated.
Right.
So now the only question is, you'd have to see, are there any peripherals? Are there lights that are going on? Are there other, you'd have to be careful about the peripheral things. But the basic structural concept would actually be permitted. And by the way, this raises a lot of questions, fascinating questions beyond the laws of Shabbos, and that is, can you write a Torah scroll with a prosthetic hands, things like that, because generally speaking, it got to be a human action. And the fundamental question you're dealing with, and even philosophically this is a question, to what extent does an integrated prosthetic device kind of become me? Is it now me? If it's controlled by my brain, controlled by my muscles, controlled by my neurological, in a way, you would say, well, gee, if I have a hip replacement, that's my leg. So it's a very exciting area, and it's going to raise a lot of halachic questions, but I would basically say how the halacha recognizes, just because you weren't born with something, if it is now functionally assimilated and integrated into your body, it just becomes part of your body, and it may be treated as a part of your body for the laws of Shabbos and the like. But again, as I say, the peripherals got to be worried about. If there are lights that go on or other things that happen. But I imagine that those things can be disconnected or modified in various ways. And you're simply dealing with a straight, muscular or neurological connection. I would think it's okay. I'll try to get you some writing on it. There are actually some halachic discussions in English.
On the note of Torah scrolls, I have seen footage of a completely independent machine that writes Torah scrolls.
Yeah, so there you got a problem. There you do have a problem because I know it can do it for sure. But then you have a halachic problem that generally speaking, these things have to be done through human activity. Now, the problem with the robot or whatever, or the machine, is, well, what does human activity mean? After all, you needed a human being to turn on the machine, right? So, program was a little more indirect, but even at the moment of when it starts doing its stuff,
Right.
So this was actually a shaila. This actually came up. I'll tell you where this came up. This came up in the 19th century with the advent of mechanical matzah baking. You know, for Passover, for the Seder, only for the Seder, you can't just use regular matzah. You got to use matzah that was specifically baked for the mitzvah of the Seder. So even if it's kosher l'Pesach matzah, if it wasn't not just baked, it has to be kneaded and baked for the mitzvah of the Seder. That's what's called shemura matzah. Like you had that's a round matzah, you know. Now, there are two types of shemura matzah. There's hand shemura, where you have the widows, you know, kneading the dough. And then you have machine, where you just dump the flour. It's like an automatic matzah maker. You dump the flour in, and the machine mixes it, kneads it, and thins it out. And that was invented like in the middle of the 19th century. And there was a lot of halachic discussion. Can machine matzahs be used at the Seder? Because given the fact that you need intention, a machine is not capable of intention. It can do the action mechanically, but it does not have the requisite intent. Torah's scroll is going to be the same problem. And the argument goes whether the human being who initiates the mechanized action, and he has the requisite intent, do I then consider this to be a continuity of his actions? So there were great Hasidic rabbis in Poland who said machine matzahs are not kosher for the Seder. Now some suggest they had a hidden agenda because it was mainly widows that were doing the hand matzah, so they didn't want to replace them in terms of charity. But that's not the reason they gave. They gave these halachic reasons. And other rabbis permit it. And as you know, to this very day, you can get two types of shmur matzah. You can get machine shmur matzah, which is square. It looks like regular matzah, but it's a bit more crunchy. And much more expensive, by the way. It's much more expensive. And hand shmur, which is the big round ones. So that dispute would have great relevance regarding the Torah scroll and the like. But my argument is an integrated prosthesis is a totally different bird. That even if we regard the machine as separate from the human, that would not be the case when you have something functioning as a limb that is integrated into my body. I would suggest that for sure would be good.
Well, what about a limb prosthetic that can be removed? Do you have to remove it and turn it off for Shabbat or a holiday?
You know, there certainly can be a difference, and I don't have a definitive answer to you, but it would seem to me that even removability is not a compelling consideration here, because its functionality is identical,
yes.
Right? So it would seem to me that the key point is not whether it's removable, although that might be a factor, but I think the ultimate logic here is not removability. The ultimate logic is what function does it serve and how is it controlled? And as long as it's controlled by my muscles and by neurological, electrical, electronic impulses, I would think there's still a good argument. You don't have to remove it. But I'm going to look into it a little bit more. But I think that there may not be a difference. The difference may not be as important as you might think. Okay, excellent question. You've been doing this for a while? And it's
3 years.
Wow, okay, that's wonderful. Okay. So anything else? I think we're about finished, but I'll take one more question if you have anything to bring up. Okay. Alrighty, so you all guys have a good, real good Shabbos, and I guess...